Okay, our topic for tonight is the boom in pulp reprints and its effect on the hobby of pulp collecting. I thought about having a panel like this because when I began coming to PulpCon about 10 years ago, I noticed then we were just starting to see a lot of reprints. Now, there's nothing new about reprint pulp stories. It's been going on since the 70s. And some members, like longtime members like Will Murray, who's here, and Bob Weinberg, were instrumental in doing a lot of pulp reprints. But just recently, over the last 8 to 10 years, there's been a real explosion in the number of reprints and in the style of them. Some of them full count facsimiles, exact replicas of the pulps themselves. Others are completely reset type, sometimes with original illustrations, sometimes with new ones. Then you've got the chapbook format, the small 5x8s, and you have expensive deluxe hardcover editions. But all in all, there's probably more reprinting going on now of the pulps than any time since the early 60s when we had the big paperback boom, and we had Burroughs and Howard and the Doc Savages and everything coming out in mass market paperback editions. Now, there's a bunch of reasons why this is happening, which we'll get into, and it mostly has to do with technology. It has to do with the advent of scanner technology, which makes it easier to copy the pulp pages. It has to do with the proliferation of print-on-demand printers who can print short runs so that a publisher no longer has to print 1,000 or 1,500 copies of a book just to make it feasible if he doesn't want to. He can print in smaller quantities. These have all made it very easy for avocational publishers and hobbyist publishers to get in and bring some of the old pulps back to life. So our panelists here, I specifically wanted on this panel because not only are they all publishers who are specializing in various forms of reprinted pulp stories, they are also collectors and in some cases dealers as well. So as we discuss this big boom in reprinting and how it is affecting the hobby, we've got guys who are more or less on the ground, so to speak, who know it from every angle. So to introduce the panelists, to my right, your left, John Gunnison, who many of you know, PulpCon regular of many years. He is a well-known dealer whose prices are occasionally reasonable. But more importantly, he is Adventure House Publishing. He has done, what was it, Pulp Digest first?
Pulp Review.
And High Adventure, which is now up to 90-some?
89.
He's also doing the G8s, which are licensed reprints. And he knows the pulp world in and out. Next to John is Tom Roberts, who is the publisher of Black Dog Books. He specializes in reprints mostly in the chapbook format, that 5.5x8.5 format. And Tom has reprinted a lot of very, very obscure adventure stories, things that are kind of outside the realm of the most popular stuff, like the Howard and the Hero Pulp kind of stuff. Tom goes in for more esoteric adventure fiction. To my left, Rich Harvey, the publisher of Bold Venture Press. He has been publishing Spider reprints. Previously, he was also involved in another reprint project doing some of the Zorro books. And Rich is very active. He's also an active collector. And on the far end, Neil Meacham of Girasol Collectibles. Neil is another familiar face to those of you who have been coming to PulpCon for some years. And in addition to being an experienced dealer, he's now publishing facsimile reprints, which are exact replicas of the pulps. And like all of the projects up here of these panels, very much desirable. So to get started here, I want to ask the panelists, and let's start with John and work our way down. Are you finding that the ready availability of reprints with a vast variety of material that's now being reprinted over these last 6, 8, 10 years, are we really satisfying people who are just interested in reading the stuff, or is it enhancing the demand for the collecting of the actual pulps themselves, or some combination in between? So, John, you want to start?
I hope it sort of does both. My model is basically to put out stuff that you wouldn't find even on most displays at PulpCon. Obviously, Spices and Saucy Movies and, you know, that material you don't find very often, but I'll go for things like Secret Service stories and Man stories and stuff. the quality of the fiction is probably not that phenomenal, but it is something that you wouldn't find. So instead of spending $300 or $400 for a book, you can pay $14.95 and get a gander at it for yourself. My idea was to give someone the ability to read some of this stuff and make a choice whether or not they liked it for themselves. And I'm really happy, though, that it is print on demand that allows me to do this, because personally, after having built a 12-foot by 32-foot shed in my backyard just to fill up the back stock of High Adventure and Pulp Reviews and all the other books that I've done, because I don't have space anymore in my house, because having to buy 1,000 copies from the printer and only selling 750 or 800, it's amazing, after 89 publications for High Adventure, how many 89 times 200 extra copies adds up quite in someone's house. But anyway, Tom?
Yeah, I would second what John would say. I think with the, particularly with the facsimiles, it provides an opportunity for people, you know, whether you're on a limited budget or whether you have concern about damaging an item that you may pay a higher expenditure for. And the Spices are some of the more obscure titles that I think people are more buying more of the facsimile and reprint material because the material is accessible, much as John was saying.
Well, but just to piggyback on that, if you think about all the pulp reprints that came out in the 60s and 70s, it was all hero-driven, whether Conan or Doc Savage or Tarzan or any of that stuff. Now all the reprints, like what Tom does, some of these forgotten writers, or like John Betancourt does with Wildside, a lot of forgotten writers that were very good, but because they were hero, a lot of the publishers wouldn't bother with them. And
paperback book too.
Right.
Rich?
Repeat that question again. I forgot about listening to those guys.
Yeah. Mr. Short Attention Span Harvey, we were saying what does the ready availability of reprints, is it has it stimulated the demand for the pulps themselves in your view?
Well, it's difficult to say, because when I started doing the Spider back in 1997 with Cat Jaster, we had people who had the original Spider pulps, and they said, oh, I don't need the reprints. And then there were people saying, I'll buy the reprints and maybe I'll sell some of these pulps before you reprint them. There were definitely people on one side of the fence or the other. I think for some people the pulps do stimulate some interest, the reprints, but I lost my train of thought.
Neil, have you anything to add?
Short number question. Going to make me forget it. I think the reprints do serve the purpose of making things available to people who aren't familiar with it in a fashion that they can afford. And for many of us in a certain age bracket, those reprints, like paperbacks and other things that were out in the 60s and 70s, were our first introduction to the pulps. Many of us hadn't seen the pulps before that, and so we got started with them by seeing those and then wanting to chase down the originals. So I think the reprint market does serve that effect. The only thing I'm concerned about is to how broad that spectrum is, because the reprints are largely only available through the pulp community already. Some of the stuff is distributed through Diamond and gets out into comic stores, but a lot of it is not stuff that is out right in front of the average person, like, for example, out in Walmart or out in Barnes & Noble or anything like that. So I don't think we're reaching the world at large with the stuff, but I think we are getting people who would be interested in it, who are maybe comic-related, who are now getting a chance to be exposed to the stuff.
Well, and that leads into my next question, and I realize that this is tough for you guys to be able to quantify, but we know, as John mentioned, if you're printing if you have a large print run, you're not selling that many, you're storing a lot. Do you have any idea, those of you who are publishing, do you think that you're reaching significant numbers of new fans and new readers? In other words, this being a relatively small community, as hobbyist communities go, a lot of us know each other, and many of us know each other. People have been coming here. A lot of people in this room have been coming here for 20 years or more. Are these new reprints reaching a significant number of new people, new buyers, or are we essentially still wading in that relatively shallow pool of real pulp aficionados? In other words, how broad is the reach of these things?
I'll admit that we are actually very much, at least I am, I'm only reaching out to those that are on my mailing list, about 4,000 people. Yes, I sell the diamond and they do buy some stuff. Hopefully that will trickle down because, you know, I remember reading Doc Savage in the 60s and really getting excited. And I, in some respects, hope that I can, you know, make a new, younger generation become excited with the pulps too. But in the other hand, I'm absolutely frightened by the idea of doing what like Galaxy will do, and we'll go to a Walmart, we'll sell 20,000 copies, whether or not they have a return privilege or not. I can't do that because my fear is that I'll go to a big distributor, and some have asked me, and what they'll do is they'll say, well, yeah, we'll take 20,000 copies. And within 6 months, I'll have 18,000 returns, and I still have the print bills to have to pay all those, you know, to pay that off, and I'm stuck holding the bag. Unfortunately, with all the distribution deals that I've had, only Diamond and Bud Planner, the only two that have paid me all of my invoices. Heroes World, which was owned by Marvel, left me owing thousands of dollars. They just decided, well, we can't pay. Same thing with Styx in Canada. Same thing with the distributor in Great Britain. Same thing with the distributor that was out of Chicago, and I'm blanking on the name right now. Had another distributor in Canada who took a bunch of stuff just before he went bankrupt so that he would have stock to sell off, that he would have extra money left over. And I just can't. I had a distributor who was putting me in Barnes & Noble, and they would order thousands of copies. They wanted to order my entire print line of 1,000, and I said, no, I can't do that, because they did exactly what I feared. And the fact is they take 750, 800 copies, and then within a couple of months I get these little notifications in the mail saying, well, out of the 800 copies we ordered, 650 were returned. And what did I get?
Well, what I think some people don't realize, though, is when you say you got returns, what they typically do is they destroy the book,
right,
and they send you an affidavit saying these were returned, meaning you don't even have the book to resell anymore.
No, yeah, in fact, High Adventure 27, which was my all-star Western issue, had Elmore Leonard, Lester Dent, Max Brand, and Hugh Cave. And I met Mr. Leonard months after the book came out, and I had to admit to him that the distributor, this periodical distributor in San Diego, got the books in the front door. Some guy in the shipping receiving department thought that they were returns and immediately wrote an affidavit for every single one of them in shit can.
Tom, your reprints are more narrowly focused in that you don't go for the broadly known authors and the broadly known characters. Mm-hmm. When you're reprinting obscure stories by, say, J. Allen Dunn or L. Patrick Green, you're naturally appealing to a relatively sophisticated, and I use the word lightly, relatively sophisticated pulp audience. Have you had much luck in selling your chapbooks to people who have not been exposed to this kind of fiction?
Since all the things I do are single author titles, there have been some of my titles which have had much larger print runs than the others, and I think subjected to either to the author or to the story type. There was an Edmund Hamilton that I did, which is a pseudo scientific mystery thing that I think expanded to many more people that normally wouldn't buy it. I mean, would buy it outside of here, and a couple of the other things. So I think it's subjective to either the material or the author. Some of the better known authors have, of course, been outside of our immediate crowd.
Now, of course, things are changing, and in terms of reaching a wider audience, there are a couple of developments which are very exciting. John alluded to one of them. We have some fellows here from Galaxy Press who are, it's a new company, they're exhibiting here for the first time, and they are undertaking a very ambitious project to get a lot of L. Ron Hubbard's pulp fiction back into print, including a lot of stories that have never been published, right?
Right.
And what I think a lot of people are very, very excited about is Anthony Tolan, who many of you know, has recently licensed the rights from Condé Nast to reprint The Shadow and Doc Savage. Those books, the first volume of his shadow reprints is available here through various dealers, and he is actively soliciting mass market distribution, as are you guys, right? So I think that there seems to be a general interest in pulp fiction that in some ways it seems to be penetrating the mainstream. The question is how much and how fast will it be, and will it really take hold? The Shadow and Doc Savage is one thing, because they have constituencies that are very well established, and they have kind of a mass market appeal that kind of transcends the pulp characters that most of us know, who the public at large would be unfamiliar with. So it remains to be seen how much of this will really take hold. Go ahead.
The issue there, I think, is whether we feel that interest in the pulps and the pulp community is expanding, remaining stagnant, or reducing. And that's a difficult question to answer, one which a lot of us are considering. Are we reaching out to new people? Are we seeing new generations of pulp collectors coming into the field? In which case, can they be enticed in by things like cheaper reprints to get them started and get them excited about the pulps? Or is this something that is shrinking or at least stagnant, and therefore we are not really going to reach those people because they're just not there to be reached?
Right. And bringing the discussion a little closer to home, so to speak, I mean, since PulpCon is primarily a gathering of people who collect the actual pulps, let's try and hone in a little tighter on the actual effect on the hobby itself. Do you guys find that there are collectors who, like me, continue to collect pulps but also collect assiduously the reprints coming out? Is that a sizable group of people? Is it growing? John, start with you.
I would say that there is a equal number of people who will continue collecting the pulps and collecting the reprints, being completists. I think we all have a little bit of OCD in all of us. And, you know, somehow that third copy of Doc Savage just fits beautifully up on that shelf, proudly. But I must admit, I think I am reaching some new people, because even with a mailing list, I'm getting new names every single month that's ordering off the website. So that tells me, but obviously I can't tell how old these people are. So I don't know if I'm rekindling the lost love or if I'm actually getting new, younger generation as of yet. But no, yes, I'm finding a lot of people who will buy both. In most cases, though, I think the vast majority of the people who are buying my reprints don't have copies of Spicy Detective, don't have copies of Saucy Movie, but they would like to have a copy, so it's not necessarily quite the same.
How about you, Tom? When you reprinted L. Patrick Green's major stories, which appeared in the magazine Short Stories originally, did you find that there was a run on the market for short stories?
No, it wasn't. There are certain things we do that are more, I won't say self-indulgent, but closer to one's personal taste. But I know when I first started appearing here more than a decade ago, I was, and Rich probably too, about the same time, close to the same age as some of the younger people in attendance, and I haven't necessarily seen a major influx of people age 30, so I don't know how many more younger people we may be bringing into the crowd, but you would hope that since there are no more pulps being made, that the reprints do allow some perpetuation to go on with the market and the interest.
Now, Rich, with the Spider, you have the distribution of Diamond, which we've referred to several times. For those of you who don't know, Diamond is I guess, probably the principal comic book distributor at this point.
Oh, absolutely.
They cast a very... No?
Basically, well, the only one.
The only one? Okay. Well, they cast a very wide net, and they reach all kinds of shops. Now, with the Spider being distributed by Diamond, you're probably reaching people... who wouldn't know J. Allen Dunn from J. Allen St. John.
Right.
So what has your experience been in terms of the feedback that you get from your customers, from Diamond, from their retail customers? I mean, is there a real excitement about this? Or do they really have a sense of who this character is and what he means?
Well, when I first started doing the Spider, the best price quote I could get was for 1,000 copies. That was actually the minimum back in 1997 I could get. This is way before Lulu, where they'll do one copy of a book. And Jack Irwin, who's a pulp collector based in South Jersey, I told him we were going to print 1,000 copies of the Spider. And in a very well-meaning way, he said, if you could, just do 500. Because he said, you'll probably sell 200, you'll be stuck with the rest for the rest of your life.
Right.
Well, we printed 1,000 of that first spider, and they didn't sell out in a week, but after about 2 years, they were all gone. So I think the pulp reprint market of the 1970s, or the market that the fan publisher was hitting in the 70s, is certainly bigger. Or maybe it's like astronomy. Maybe those stars have been out there for several millennia, and we just could never see them because we never had the right telescope. I think the spider reprints, though, a lot of people would approach me and say, oh, I read the spider in the 70s when Pocket Books did them, or when the media did them, or people would contact me and say, oh, I've always heard about the spider. A lot of people would say they've read Steranko's History of the Comics. And, of course, he had that long chapter. So some people have an idea of who this character is. Mostly they associate him with the Shadow. He's like the Shadow, right? And I say, well, kind of. He's a little nuttier than the Shadow. There's a much higher body count, but yeah, he's like the Shadow.
Well, I must admit, when the publisher of Collector's Press came to, in discussion with Frank Robinson and I in reference to pulp culture, and after the book had already been completed and we were going to film and they finally decided on the title, he asked me in a phone conversation along with Frank at the same time, he says, so how many copies do you think I can sell? And I just sort of laughed and thought, God, my limited ability. I don't think you can sell more than a couple thousand copies. His print run was 10,000, and he sold 10,000 in no time at all. He then went back for another printing of 5,000 and sold most of that. The difference was is that he got great publicity because it was something that people had not seen in a long time. And I always reached out for that holy grail and hoped that I could do the same thing. But, you know, it's pictures are one thing, fiction is another.
Yeah.
And as Diamond has told me in my last meeting with them a couple of weeks ago, on a new project I was pushing them, they said, it's got fiction in it? And, we'll order a couple hundred copies.
Yeah. Well, part of what we're seeing, too, is that with any collectible, there are always the diehards who have to have the original, if I understood the original question they had there. And I don't think the reprints are discouraging people who are serious collectors from buying original pulps. In some cases, we're seeing people who are buying a reprint of something expensive to have it as a placeholder or as a reading copy, but they're still chasing the originals. But a large portion of the market for reprints are, as John said before, people who would not buy those pulps anyway. So I don't think the reprints are causing people not to buy pulps, nor are they necessarily spurring people to buy more pulps. It's perhaps two sides of the coin, and they're not overlapping to a great extent.
Well, Neil, you're also a dealer as well as a publisher, as is John. What have you seen in terms of the pricing? Now, a lot of the books that you do, you get into the spices, which, as we know, are very pricey pulps. Mm-hmm. And John has done some of the spices and the saucies as well. Have you seen any pressure downward on the prices of the originals?
No, not really at all. Again, people who are buying the reprints aren't necessarily looking for those pulps in original form. Also, your reprint doesn't cost a proportionate amount of the original item that you're buying. So you can buy a reprint of a $1,000 book just as easily as you can buy a reprint of a $100 book, and your reprint costs the same. But in terms of the original pulps, the availability is so limited on a lot of the scarcer items that I don't think it's really doing any harm. People who are collecting the early Weird Tales, for example, are not going to look at the reprint and go, that'll do me, I'll just put that on the shelf. They want the originals because of the collectability of the originals themselves. So we're not seeing that pushing prices down.
But in the other way, though, I have found that because Doc Savage has been reprinted so many times, and I saw this earlier with the Avenger, when you reprinted every Avenger, the number of people really looking who might have started off saying, yeah, I'd really like to collect Doc Savage, but didn't have a lot of money, they were just buying the reprints. They weren't buying the original pulps. And I think that there is, although the prices haven't come down dramatically, but the number of people wanting to buy certain books, I think, has reduced.
Possibly true, but we also get into the material is getting to be somewhat dated, particularly some of the hero characters are not what you would consider to be the current style. So I think the time lapse is also getting to be a problem in terms of what people who are coming into the market looking for reading material now are actually looking for versus the stuff that's in the pulps. I agree that stuff that has been reprinted several times is probably not as much interest as something that they haven't seen before, but we're facing other issues as well as far as
people.
Because to hand somebody who's maybe in their 20s now, Doc Savage, and say, read this, you'll love it, are they going to or not? You know, it's hard to say.
Well, let's presuppose, looking forward, that all of the reprints will stimulate a certain amount of interest in pulp as a whole, and that certain, well, let's also stipulate that certain genres or certain characters will do better in reprint than others. What I'm wondering is if we try and gaze into a crystal ball, assuming that the plethora of reprints just continues to expand and there's more and more of them, and they don't need to sell 1,000 or 1,500 copies to break even with print on demand, Will that be enough to satisfy the reader? Do we run a risk, and I ask this question as a collector myself, most of us here are passionate collectors and hobbyists, do we have any real fear that the hobby of collecting the original pulps will dwindle? I mean, are we seeing a contracting community, or do you think that these reprints will in time actually expand the group more? John, let's start with you and work down.
I would actually hope that it would expand. Whether or not it's making it contract, I'm not quite certain. the number of orders that I continue to get, the number of catalogs that I print, is larger and larger every single catalog that I do. So in some respects, I guess that's not necessarily true, but the number of people actually buying from those catalogs, I think, has leveled off or actually decreased a little bit. So that could be pricing, that could be, you know, what I'm offering, that could be, you know, many different things, so it's kind of hard to quantify.
Well, you also have to be concerned. This is why you charge for a catalog and refund on an order, because some people are just using your price catalog as a price guide, you know, using it on the reference shelf, aren't they?
Oh, I've had, you know, a number of the first big catalog I put out, it got turned into in fact, I walked into an antique mall, this was before Tim Cottrell's thing, and, you know, probably in the reference section was my catalog back there as the so-called price guide. And I knew at that point that I just had to charge something because it was costing me too much money to give away.
I think the impact of some of that is hard to gauge, though, because in the last number of years, the method of getting the word out to people has changed enormously. When we first started collecting a few decades ago, you could scrape up a few catalogs from people here or there. You had ads in the backs of comics. Now with the internet, all of that has changed. The availability for collectors is greater now than it ever was before, because you can go online and search it. There are more shows now than there ever have been in the past that are related to it. But there's no more pulps, per se, so they're getting spread a little bit thinner. So it's hard to see what the balance is of what is the available material, how many new people are coming into it, and how is it being affected by the new methods of tracking that stuff down. Because equally, the net has brought a lot of stuff out, but then is it also getting new people interested, in which case they're buying it up? And so it's hard to say where where the quantities are.
Tom, what's your sense of this?
I would hope that all the reprints would bring a larger audience, or at least a larger awareness of the market. If you wave a flag in a closet, nobody's going to see it. If you wave it outside and scream, people may think you're annoying, but at least people know you're there. So, you know, I would hope. But I would hope that at least makes people more aware of the market, because as we all know, there's no more books being made. So to supplement the decreasing number of books, either through atrophy, through destroying, which anybody who's reprinted things, we know the damage that we cause, regardless of how much we may try to later recoup or cover up from that. There is damage that's caused to specific or sometimes high-priced items to reprint them, and through the advance of technology, anybody who's a collector, you know, I order things from overseas all over the place, and things are shipped all over the world now. So, you know, all those things that used to be contained within our continental North America and the UK are now shipped to New Zealand and Brazil and all over the world. So the contingency of material that used to be here for the collectors is now trying to encompass the entire world. So I hope that the reprints find somewhere to go and bring more people in.
Yeah, I would say, as someone who's not a full-time dealer, or I would say a large-scale dealer, but as somebody who sells frequently on eBay as well as here at the shows, I would say that there seems to be a general sense among those shoppers on eBay that they are beginning to be aware of more that's out there other than the titles, their narrow interests that they originally went to the internet to look up. In other words, you can't help, thanks to websites like pulp.net and some of the others, the various Yahoo groups and the Usenet news groups, even if you enter the hobby just looking for, say, shadow reprints or shadow pulps or Doc Savage or Robert E. Howard material, the fact is it's so easy now with the internet to reference so many different sites that you're bound to be exposed to a much wider range of material. And I think that should really help in the long run. I don't know if we're going to see it in the next 2 years, 3 years, or 5 years, but I would think if the reprints keep up, that we certainly should see more people drift into the hobby that will offset the attrition of our own group. And let's face it, as hobbyists go, as collector groups go, we have a relatively small one. And the fact that most of us know each other after all these years, proves that point. So I want to throw a curveball to the guys. I want to ask them, let's start with you, Neil, and work down this end.
Can I have glass of my watch back here?
You can have your watch back when we're finished, Neil. What would be your, forget about commercial considerations, forget about what you think would sell well for you or something that is easy for you to do one way or the other. Each of the panelists, what is a reprint project, a title or a series or a character? What is something you'd really like to do and say, boy, I wish, this is what I really want to see back in print, and I don't care if it sells or not. Let's start with you and work down.
That's a tough one. You mean speaking personally?
Personally.
Well, personally for me, probably the favorite would be The Shadows. See those in reprint. Personally, I'm a fan of a faithful facsimile version because the original nature of the pulps has a lot of interest to me in terms of the ads, how they looked, how they were done, what they looked like when you picked it up at first. I don't care personally for reset text or redone illustrations. That's not really what I'm there for. I want some of the original experience, which is why Lee and I chose to go the route that we did with our own line. But that would probably be my first choice as far as seeing a project there. Second is one that we've been involved in for quite some time in the early years of Weird Tales, not so much because of the great reading, pardon me, Bob, if you're in the room, but because of the scarcity of those issues and the significance of some of that early material, the early Lovecraft, and the change in the style of horror writing to what it became and what we know as now. I think there's a lot of historical significance to some of that material that actually exceeds the value of reading it, if that makes any sense. And you can sort of read some of them and go, it's not great, but you can see what it had to offer and why it was important to what came after. So that would probably be the two most significant ones for us.
Rich, what's your dream project?
Well, it's hard to say. I'm Dawn the Spider. A couple of years ago, I released Dominant Ladies, and that was one I wanted to work on because I felt she was a character that was very overlooked. And a lot of people asked, why are you going to reprint Dominant Ladies? But it actually did pretty well.
Ed Race.
Oh, yeah, Ed Race. Well, you know, the only thing is now the Ed Race stories I include with the Spider reprint. Otherwise, I probably would do a little more of those chat books. I would kind of like to dig through some of the Spices and reprint in anthologies some of the series characters because I like the replicas, but I also like resetting the text and sometimes getting new art because I think sometimes that helps bring in new readers because I think if the only way you present it to them is as a replica, you're almost saying, well, this stuff is great if you keep it in the proper context. And that's fine, but I also think that sometimes there's a reason to reset it to show that people, well, no, look, it can be presented as something new and still have appeal on its own. I don't know if there's really any project right now I'm dying to do. I would like to see maybe some replicas or reprints of Diamond Detective or Black Mask done in their actual format because I think sometimes we don't quite realize. It's almost like talking about classic television in the 1960s. People would rattle off their favorite programs, and then one day I got a hold of an old TV guy and looked at it, and I realized, wow, in one evening, you had to choose at 7:30 between either watching The Green Hornet, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., or, you know, something else, and it was that way with The Dime Detective. Up until a few years ago, I had never actually owned The Dime Detective, and when I opened it up and saw on the contents page, Raymond Chandler, Earl Stanley Gardner, Daly, and several others, all within one issue. Then it just struck me what a significant pulp dime detective was. You know, I always assume that those authors are in every issue, but not all of them in one single issue. So,
No, and you know, I'd second that myself, because Dime Detective, I mean, Black Mask is unquestionably significant for its contribution to the hard-boiled genre, but Dime Detective has a lot of great stuff that has not seen nearly the exposure, mostly because they didn't generate the new guys of the stature of Hammett and Chandler, and even the Black Mask guys that they appropriated, Frederick Nebel and Gardner and later Carol John Daly, they are more associated with The Mask than with Dime Detective, but there's a lot of great stuff there. And if I had my druthers, that's one title that I would love to see, whether it was facsimile form or whether it was just as collections with reset type, trade paperbacks, chapbooks. I'd love to see entire issues of Dime Detective. Tom, what's your dream project?
To see John do Dusty Ayers.
Maybe you could pay for it then, and then he'd do it.
I don't know if I can speak objectively about all financial considerations aside. Anybody who's ever looked at my backlist will know I don't have any financial considerations with some of the obscure things I've done. When the pulps were actually being published, the world was a much smaller place, not necessarily through population, but through what was considered exotic locales and things like that. So much in science fiction and mystery and detective and hero things have been done. I have a soft spot for adventure fiction, and I would like to see more adventure stuff, whether it's the adventure title itself proper be done or some of those more type of fiction. A lot of the authors that wrote that were very versed in different societies and cultures of different places in the world, and were extremely gifted in manipulating the English language, and many of them are lost and forgotten today. So I'd like to see some of those people either more recognized or just the genre more recognized.
Good. John?
I'd like to have a project in which I'm not so ADD and not spread myself so thin doing 300 projects like what I'm doing now, which I really wanted to do and sort of got myself involved with, because John Locke and Gene Christie were putting together something that was going to be for the entire Thrill book. And I said, well, you got to make that a book. You can't just make it a CD and let people look at a TIFF image. You got to make it a book. And so we're trying to put together, albeit very slowly, mostly on my part, what will probably be a three-volume set of Thrill book. Some interesting stuff, some horrid stuff, but some scary stuff nonetheless. And I really like it only because I'm such a Harold Hershey geek, I got to see where he began outside of the, starting right there, the editorship at the Throat Book.
Well, if nothing else, you can see from tell by the responses. I mean, we have a tremendous variety and diversity of not only the formats in which reprints are presented and made available today, but also in the type of material that people want to see and would like to publish themselves. So I think it's a healthy thing altogether, and it's something we should all encourage. And it can be pretty costly if you want to keep up with everybody's reprints, because there's an awful lot of them nowadays. But I think in the long run, if we all do that, it's going to stimulate interest. And sooner or later, the good stuff is going to seep into the population, and everything is cyclical. And all the people who were introduced to, say, Doc Savage from the Bantam reprints of the 60s, maybe there will be a new generation that'll take to it again, and maybe there'll be just enough of them to filter over and find places like PulpCon and help keep our hobby fun and vibrant. With the closing minutes of our panel, I'd like to throw it open to you folks. Anybody who has questions for any of our publishers, either in their capacities as publishers or dealers or collectors, or if you just have comments, things, your own favorite reprints. Will?
I don't have a question. I have a comment. I was involved with the early PulpCon. And our formula was 1,000 copies. And we knew if we printed 1,000 copies, we'd eventually sell out. Some books sooner, some books later, in terms of exhilarity, a long time selling. But, 30 years later, it is 30 years since Odyssey began. You're talking about the same numbers, 1,000 copies.
Less, actually, now.
Less. So there's been a little disruption. In addition, if you say you can sell 1,000 spiders, at least still sell 1,000 spiders?
Lately it's been more like 750 or 800.
Okay, so we are seeing a little attrition.
Yeah.
So if that answers the question, do we have growth? I guess the answer is no.
Well, not necessarily, because it depends on whether you view the collecting pot of available money as finite. Because if it is, and you assume that there's only so much money being spent by only so many people, now that there are more and more items for them to choose from, each person is only able to buy so many. So consequently, somebody who used to buy 3 or 4 items is still only buying 3 or 4 items, but there's 50 to choose from now. So it's hard to gauge how that's working.
Well, we haven't changed a lot.
Well, one thing I think is that even though there's been a tiny dip, I think with the internet and stuff like that, there's the potential to get those people back in one big whoosh, but you need the big projects like Robert E. Howard's Conan, Tony Tolan reprinting The Shadow. I think the problem is, though, like with Tony, things might be a little bit different because he's one of us, but let's face it, you know, those Conan books with the Gary Gianni artwork, they're beautiful, but there's no reference to anyone's Fight Stories collection by Robert E. Howard or anything else. Every big publisher is doing their own thing, and there's no way to get people back into this hobby unless, of course, they started giving out free house ads, which they're not going to do.
Unfortunately, I think we are, as a group, at ZPG, Zero Population Growth, and we've all been trying to get a population growth amongst us. I need to see the bastard children.
Hey, back here.
Well, you talk about the Howard books. Everybody ever told me doing his own thing, not referencing any of the others. The thing, and I don't know if this really applies much exactly or parallel, but the Burroughs boom in the 60s and 70s, you look in the back, and I can't think of Valentine or maybe it was just maybe Paul Dark folks. You had a list of fanzines, of Burroughs fanzines. And you know, they were all from different places. Now, they weren't other commercial ventures necessarily, but that was something that happened then, and I don't know if it helped fuel that Burroughs, but
I think those lists were in the back because I believe some of the Burroughs. More people into it than I was, I like to tell, but I believe Vern Coriel and different people were the consultants to Valentine on those projects, and I think that's how they arranged their lists. I know Glenn Lord did that with some of the Howard material, where the material would be listed in the paperback reprints.
Yeah. So. Well, I think one thing that helps, too, is that Burroughs, a lot of that material is owned by Edgar Rice Burroughs Incorporated. Another character who has been around this for almost a century is Zorro, and he's owned by Zorro Productions. You've got a company that's built on one character, and whatever they can do to keep the word out and keep it alive, they're going to do it.
But also realistically, for an individual publisher, there's not necessarily any gain for you to promote somebody else's stuff in the back of your book. So particularly since who do you put in, who do you leave out, how does it work, which ones are still current, which ones are not. So it's tough to say, yeah, we'll put a list in the back of available sources of this material and do everybody justice, including yourself. So
that's probably something that the copyright owner stipulates to the publisher. You got to have a list of our fanzines and stuff.
Right. Who else has got a comment?
This is the point. I'm from Galaxy Mentions, and we're launching a new line of 100 books. I've been going around the last 6 months, and just to address the point about the new audience, one point just reported today from the local Times. She knew nothing about pulps. And by the time of an hour touring around, and a lot of you were very gracious to just talk to her and give her a lot of information, I had no idea. It was her basic realization, and that this is the root of American popular entertainment. And when she had that realization, she was going to took a little blurb she's going to do on the scene, make a major feature article, which should come out tomorrow, and then a photographer will come over. Basically, she wasn't aware of what it was. You know, as soon as she had the realization, she went, wow, now I really want to read this stuff and find out, you know, more about the pulse.
It's Tiggs time.
Yeah. Thank you, Tiggs, for that musical interlude.
The point that I think is real key when, you know, and John made some reference to, like, I'm doing some of the bigger numbers when I went and spoke with the buyer from Walmart. when she saw some of Howard's lessons, she read one of them, and she was just, her viewpoint was like, this is the last box of books in the attic, so she set out and take these big numbers, because specifically the Westerns, because that's for public. And the thing I'm finding is that if we let people know what it is and get it to the right people to read, you know, the published weekly and library journal, when I'm showing them some of these covers, you think they would already be familiar with it. And they just, the senior editor of the library journal, she's just like, I can't believe this stuff. This is incredible.
Yeah. One of the problems pulp collecting has always faced is that the majority of people on the street, so to speak, are not aware of what they are. Everybody
right.
knows what comic books are. Everybody knows what paperbacks are, partly because they are still, in one form or another, available currently.
Right.
Whereas with the pulps, they've been extinct for a long time, and they aren't the sort of thing that you see just lying around in used bookstores anymore or even in antique shops. So most people that you talk to aren't aware of what they were or what was in
right.
them. And what they might be missing.
Plus, the word pulp was used in the majority
right.
a lot over the last, since the pulps died. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually think, I mean, we're probably kidding ourselves if we believe that no matter how many reprints there are, that somehow there's going to be a huge awakening in the entire population as to the merits of pulp fiction. But there is, of course, the aspect that, and this is a topic for another panel, I think there are a lot of people, including people who are fairly knowledgeable about American pop culture, who fail to realize the extent to which pulp has contributed to our pop culture, not just in terms of specific characters, but in terms of the storytelling formula that filtered down from pulps of the teens and the 20s into movies, into dramatic radio, into slick fiction, and later even into television. So that's a subject for another discussion. But I wish you guys well, and I hope your research pays off for you, because it'll bring a lot more L. Ron Hubbard fiction to the rest of us. Have we got time for one or two more comments or questions? Yes, sir.
This is not a question exactly, although I have questions and a comment to make. But first of all, relative to the last few comments that have been made, I think, I don't know how many of you need this information, but let me try this. I taught writing of all sorts at Penn State from 1966 to roughly 1990. Most of my students want to be writers, some want to very badly, some merely got wistful about it. And they learn a lot. And they're very interested in plotting stories and all that sort of thing. And again, I was staggered by the fact that I rarely hit anybody who knew about pulp magazines. And very many times, I bring pulp magazines to class. And I have a limited collection, but I have a pretty wide one, pornography, westerns, and various things like this, and I hold them up. And by and large, the reaction was astonishment. They didn't know about it. They certainly didn't know that these were as wide. And yet, well, one reason they're very much interested in as writers, I'll be talking about that a bit tomorrow, was the fact they were impressed by something I kept saying over and over again, that it gave writers in my day a chance to earn while they learn. This impressed them enormously. But the color on the covers, the inside illustration, was a new world to almost all of us, going back to the 1960s. They didn't know about it. Now, I just want to mention that there is a huge audience out there that has never heard of the pulps. On the other hand, there were teachers I knew at Penn State who would casually refer to pulp magazine writing or to pulp magazine thinking, and they said it contemptuously, as if the audience they were addressing knew what they were talking about. And again, I point out that that the students did not know they were talking about. It is kind of, I feel, a sort of a lost moment. And even though I endured by a hell of a lot of moments, a moment. All right, that's the comment. Now, the question. Another comment. I'm very I'm very interested in reprints. I'm fascinated by what I see of reprints here, but I buy them and read them for one reason only. I'm revisiting my boyhood. I'm revisiting my adolescence. And I rarely buy a reprint in an area where I didn't do a lot of reading at one time. Getting back to one more moment now. I have a question which is involving me as a writer. Are these reprints merely, what can I say, something, what are the economics of it? Is that just the cost of printing? Do the writers get anything? Do the publishers get anything? Is there any, are these real businesses in the publishing sense of the word? I gather not.
Yes, in terms of how much money some of us lose if they do it. Yes, in terms of how much money some of us lose if they do it.
All right.
I think what you're trying to get at is it an industry similar to work as the pulse for an industry? No, it's infinitely smaller than that. Some of us are doing reasonably well, but in a very small way, because it is a very small market. So I think that's where pulp publishing is now, and probably where it's always going to be.
But I think the question specifically referred to matters of licensing and copyright. In other words, are the writers who produce the work, many cases work for hire, are they compensated? And I believe, I don't want to put words in anybody's mouth, but a lot of the reprints are public domain pulps which were not renewed, but the ones that have copyrighted characters with estates attached, yes, there are licensing fees paid, and presumably the copyright holders...
Realistically, though, most of the actual authors are deceased, so if the rights are owned, it's usually owned by another individual or by a company of some sort.
Well,
so,
there are writers who have left estates, which are still in the business market, so to speak, are publishing. I don't know any estate, and I'm friendly with a number of people who run estates, that has, how shall I say, made anything out of reprint. But they usually make money out of movie sales, television sales, things like that. This is a whole area of concern.
In some cases, I think people assume that families and estates and whatnot automatically own the rights to the material that their predecessors wrote, and that is not necessarily true. Rights renewals were more complicated in the past than the automatic assignment of rights now. So Burroughs, for example, copyrighted his material and owned it himself and was certainly a business-like person about it. A lot of the writers wrote their stuff, got their checks, the company owned it, the company did whatever it wanted with it in the end, and if it went belly up, a lot of the stuff became public domain.
I know that almost all writers I knew at the time, myself included, sold all rights to their first few stories. But in almost all magazines, there was a check, a street submit, which bought all rights, then announced a policy of turning the rights back to the authors. And this happened elsewhere. One last thing, as long as I'm talking about it, I want to throw one other point. I don't know how people hear, how much time they have spent talking about or learning about what happened to the pulps. And I have detected, as somebody, probably the same, but relatively new to this particular area, I have detected a kind of a yearning feeling that they will not forget it. The song will come back again. And I'm not very much awareness of the changes in entertainment, the changes in distribution, the changes in aesthetics, if you will, that caused the pulps to disappear. But, for example, back in the 1950, there was a tremendous loss in circulation of pulp magazines across the board for two reasons. One, because the comic books came on very strong. Second, because the paper books came on very strong. And third, most of all, editors and publishers told me again and again, because the American News Company disappeared. And there's nobody distributing them anymore. I do know that the remaining science fiction magazines have faced declining circulations, and they have no distribution. If somebody were to start a magazine distribution firm again, there'd be an awful lot of people who would latch on to.
But I hold no such illusions that the Pulse would be riding high again. I hope that maybe I could start selling 1, 2, 3,000 copies, but was quickly beat into the sense of no way, it's not going to happen. And publications nowadays, magazines are not doing well. Newspapers are not doing well. The printed media in itself is not doing well.
Reading and literacy is apparently declining in spite of the availability of education and the printed word being available to more and more people.
Right.
So if you look at the younger generation, their entertainments are not largely reading-based. They are video-based, they are movie-based, and I don't think we are really going to see that change in our culture revert back to reading to that kind of extent. Unfortunately, it will be very nice if it did, but we can't see that in the future.
Right. I would love to keep going, folks, but there's somebody in the back with a hook coming this way, so we're going to have to get going for the auction. Thank you very much for attending. Please patronize all our publishers here. Their wares are available.